This is The Takeaway with Melissa Harris-Perry from WNYC and PRX in collaboration with GBH News in Boston.
The largest book ban in America is not in a school district or even a local public library. It's in American prisons. These bans can come from prison-wide, state, or federal policies and are aimed mostly at material that is deemed sexually explicit, detrimental to security, or that disrupts the social order of a prison. But sometimes it can seem sort of arbitrary. Previously, books like Freakonomics were banned in prisons in Texas, and a federal prison in Colorado in 2009 blocked an inmate from reading President Barack Obama's memoir because it was deemed to be potentially detrimental to national security.
This call is from an inmate at Washington Correction Center.
Hello. My name is Christopher Blackwell. I'm an incarcerated journalist in Washington State. I'm the co-founder of Look to Justice and a key member with Empowerment Avenue.
Christopher is incarcerated at a Washington State facility and is serving a 45-year sentence for robbery and a murder he committed in his 20s. Last month, Christopher wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about having a right to read and to get an education, even while incarcerated. And he told about his own experience with book restrictions.
I was working with Dr. Michael Kimmel, who focuses a lot on toxic masculinity and edda-related topics. And it was a topic that has recently been really important to me in kind of understanding like how individuals are focused on violence and how we use violence to solve a lot of our issues as males and individuals that come from impoverished communities. And when Mr. Kimmel sent in his book from our discussion, the Department of Corrections decided to reject the book. And that kind of put me on edge. And I was like, well, this seems a little ridiculous. And then when I seen what their reason was for rejecting the book, that it could possibly cause basically an uprising in the prison, I thought it was even a little more ludicrous. So I decided that, all right, we need to fight this here.
I'll just note right here that we reached out to the Washington State Department of Corrections to hear why they denied access to Michael Kimmel's book, Angry White Men. And they said it was rejected because, quote, the content could reasonably be thought to lead or add to tensions between groups, specifically in a prison setting. They also noted that Christopher appealed and was granted access to the book.
You know, it made me think that we need to put this on a bigger platform, that these kinds of books would be rejected from people that are inside.
So, Christopher, I get it. On the one hand, the idea that a book addressing toxic masculinity would cause a prison uprising, right, seems like actually the opposite of what it might cause. But but on the other hand, you know, as somebody who, you know, traffics in ideas, I don't hate the idea that being exposed to ideas might lead people to behave differently and maybe in ways that really challenge the system.
Right. I mean, I think there's a line between the two, and we also like want to make sure that we retain our right to, you know, free speech and our right to like read and educate ourselves and things like that. And I think sometimes we navigate in a system with the Department of Corrections where they have a real gray area of like trying to protect the safety and security of the prison, which, you know, is completely understandable in, you know, means where that would be necessary. Like if I was trying to get the anarchist cookbook or something crazy like that, you know, that would be completely understandable that we wouldn't want that coming inside the prison. But on the other hand, you know, it's important to know that like we cannot have people just deciding when it comes to free speech and things like that. Like that's why we have laws and the Constitution and just, you know, just like sheer logic and understanding that like prisoners reading certain things like this would be beneficial to them changing the way they live their life and reentering society with a lot more knowledge and a better aspect and take on how they should live their life and interact with our fellow citizens.
What are you reading right now?
Well, right now I've been reading a lot of bell hooks. I've been reading some Miriam Kaba and trying to sharpen up on some other areas. I'm really focused on like the whole aspect of toxic masculinity and how, like, as males and as individuals that come from certain kinds of communities, that we end up with the mindset that violence is our only way to deal with conflict or harm or any kind of avenue where we feel targeted, that we just don't have other outlets, but we do. you know, we do have a lot of ways to deal with conflict resolution and just having like communication and building communication skills so you know how to talk about and navigate when you have these kinds of issues in your life. And I think that for me, like, that's been my core focus lately, is to better understand that, because not only has that helped me, but it also gives me the skills to like share that with other individuals so we can start to change that kind of mindset and that kind of thing around how we live and how we deal and solve problems.
You write in the op-ed about how powerful it was for you to have an opportunity to begin education while incarcerated, and how different it was than simply having like physical outlets. Talk to me about that. What difference did it make for you to have the books and the smart people and the tough conversations?
Right. So education to me is, you know, we always hear people ask, like, what's the aha moment, a defining moment in an individual's life when they are on the wrong path or something, and just something sparks and they begin to just shift into a different path. And for me, and, you know, for a lot of people I know, you know, it's always different, but for me it was education. And it wasn't a special moment or anything like that. I like to define these moments and this transformation as when someone actually builds their self-confidence and their self-esteem, and that this inherently, when this is developed in a person, they love themselves, and when they love themselves, they can't harm others, because that would inadvertently only harm themselves again. So I know that's what education did for me, is education helped me build and construct a really strong confidence and self-esteem for myself, because I hadn't had that growing up. I grew up in a really poor community. When I went to school, like, our schools were, you know, full of gangs and drugs and violence and things like that. So our schools and our teachers were more focused on behavior opposed to our education, I feel like. And when that happens, you tend to just fall further and further behind. And when that happens, you know, you start to feel dumb and you don't belong and things like that. So, you know, I never, for myself, was able to build that confidence that I could pass a class with an A, or that I could write a constructive paper or do critical thinking or even read a book. I had never read a book until I had came to prison, you know, and I came to prison at the age of 22. So I think that these things are just core foundations. And when we see that we can actually do these things, that we are a part of the general society as a whole.
For many activists, there's been a push to defund and divest from the police and from carceral systems, pointing out that instead we should be putting money in places like the schools, into the communities that experience poverty, like the community that you grew up in. But sometimes that disinvestment does mean that for folks who are incarcerated, you have fewer programs, fewer opportunities. Have you experienced that?
Right. So, of course, that stuff happens and that stuff's talked about. And I think a lot of the time the narratives around some of these conversations get misconstrued around what defund can mean, right? So, like, when we talk about the carceral state, like, yes, defunding in the carceral state would be great, but we don't want to defund in the areas that are actually going to build the characters of which I, you know, mentioned before, where we want to build a character who has confidence and self-esteem that we can put back in community as a society member, not as an other. We can't ever do anything that creates another, because when we create another, then someone feels like they don't belong, and that's inadvertently how people get out and they just continue to cause harm. So when we talk about getting rid of these programs and these things that are actually really helpful to individuals developing and changing on that path, you know, that is an investment into society, right? Like, we're actually taking away something from society. That part to take away from would be is to helping heal and develop individuals that can safely return society to society in a safe timeline, right? And that divestment can come from holding people incarcerated for decades past when their sentence is due. You know, I know a lot of gentlemen in here that are incredible human beings. They're transformers. They do great work. They're mentors. They're teachers. You know, and they've been down for decades and have decades left on their sentence. If they were reinstated into the community, they would be the individuals doing the work in the community. And I know a lot of friends that did decades and are now out in the community, and they are the ones doing the violence reduction work. They are the ones doing gang prevention and out there working with the kids to help them see that there's other opportunities and things like that. So, yeah, we should pull money out of some of these systems in those ways. but only if we're investing in the healthy ways to where we can make sure that we're actually helping and building communities that need this.
Do you know anyone who's had an opportunity to have a Pell Grant while incarcerated?
I have.
Can you talk a little bit about the importance?
I've been a beneficiary of that. And I mean, again, it's so like education changed my life. Like having the chance to educate myself, having the chance to learn how to read, how to critically think, like that changed my life. And, you know, I know a lot of people say, like, why would this person who's in prison get a free education when, you know, I have to pay for my kids' education? You know, that's one side of the coin that is an argument. But I would also say is that it's not just getting a free education. It's usually people that are in prison getting this come from impoverished communities, communities where we would have not had the chance to go to college and things like that. And again, it's an investment in society. When we better someone who doesn't know how to get by because they've been taught all these things that have been damaging and harmful for how they live their life, and we invest in that human being to then become a productive member of society, then again, we have a better society for all people, you know. So having that kind of stuff in prison is instrumental because it is one of the cornerstones to changing and developing a human life and bringing worth to that life. And I think that that's an investment that's worth having, right?
Can you give me a reading list? If there were, say, a few books, a handful, four or five, that you think really everybody right now ought to be reading, what's on your reading list?
I think they should be reading Mariam Kaba, We Do This Till We Free Us. They should definitely read The Four Agreements. I would definitely take a second to read Michael Kimmel's book, Angry White Men. That really helped me understand a lot of things of where people's entitlements and feelings come from. You know, and I would just say anything of a topic that you feel strongly about around incarceration, around poverty, around activism work, and you have a strong opinion, but you might not have both sides to the story. Like, read something about that. Read some of the other side. Maybe you'll think about it a little different. I would encourage people to do that. You know, when I watch the news, I watch all the news stations. I don't limit myself to CNN or MSNBC or Fox or anything like that. I read or I watch a little bit of all of them, right? So I have a little more in my mind to kind of help me form and critically think about how I want to make a decision. You know, so I am educated around the things that I say that I'm passionate about, you know. So I would just encourage people to, like, dive into some of that.
So we were talking, you were talking a little bit about all of the different news sources, CNN, MS, Fox, that you want to be exposed to in order to, you know, really build your own worldview and perspective. What are, in addition to books, what are the kinds of news sources and information that you have access to?
So, I mean, when it comes to access to information, we do have cable TV, so we are able to watch the news stations, both national and local. And then I have a lot of, you know, people that are willing to send me stuff that comes in. So if I see something or if I kind of lock onto a topic and want to learn more about it, like, I can have articles and stuff sent in. We have access to buy newspapers and stuff like that if we want to have a subscription for that. So that's also another good source.
And nobody's worried that watching cable news might cause a riot in the prison?
They don't seem to be worried about that. And I think, again, I would be a little worried if that was the excuse on why we couldn't watch cable news. You know, I think this is important. You know, like, when we talk about, like, some of the other countries and how they deal with incarceration, like Germany, let's take Germany for a fact. You know, when Germany incarcerates an individual, they have a core belief that this is one of our citizens and that it is not our job to punish and harm this individual, but our job to try to reshape this individual and get them prepared to reenter society in a healthy manner so they don't ever cause harm again in our society. And I mean, that's, again, like, one of the things why I say it's so dangerous in creating an other. If we put people in prison and constantly do these kinds of things, like draconian kind of thoughts of how we deal with incarceration, then we're always going to end up with someone worse off, and that someone goes back. So, like, we don't want to strip them down from things. We don't want to cast them off in ways. We want to add to them and build to them. I mean, someone inner broken, we need to fix them, right?
Why do you think we don't approach incarceration that way in this country?
I think because we believe in the prison industrial complex. I think the prison system has become a profiting thing. We trade private prisons on the stock exchange. We have, you know, companies like Securus and Global Tellink and JPay that make hundreds of millions of dollars off of local phone calls that are free to the rest of the society. They charge for emails that are free to society. You know, we have created an industry around prisons that now all these companies hire lobbyists and go and lobby politicians and fund their campaigns. And I mean, I think that, you know, we could solve incarceration, mass incarceration in the United States with one bill if the president said, you know what, you can't profit off prisons anymore. Profiting off prisons isn't going to happen. We're not going to stand for it. And that would be the end of mass incarceration because no one would be invested in just holding people in prison. You know, a lot of the fear-mongering and stuff that's done around prison and the individuals that are inside prison, you know, is done for those reasons, to continue to allow the prison industrial complex to keep running like a well-oiled machine. And not that people in prison haven't caused serious harm. I've caused serious harm to my community, and I'm very accountable for that. But what needs to happen is I need to learn how to be responsible and accountable for that, and I need to work through that so I never do that again, because I am coming home. So I want to come home to be the best person I can and offer the most I can.
Christopher Blackwell is incarcerated in the state of Washington. He's co-founder of the nonprofit Look to Justice. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.